nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so I guess this is the last of this series of lectures, and last 4 days we've been trying to develop this viewpoint, you know, this what we call the bottom-up viewpoint, that you can use to think of any nanoscale device or even bigger devices. And we kind of bottom-up means you start from the smallest thing and then see what happens as you put in more and more complications into the story. And if you remember, the basic things that go in there is this H, the Hamiltonian, that describes your actual channel, the active region. And then you have these two contacts. Any current flow process must always have two contacts at least. And those are described by the sigma 1, sigma 2, and this connection to the context. So, and then there is the interaction with quote-unquote surroundings. And that's where this U and the sigma S all come in. And surroundings means things like phonons, magnets, anything else that could be influencing your current flow. But another very important part there is that this is based on a one electron picture. And of course, in practice, there's many more electrons involved in this. And the way you think about it is as if one electron feels some average potential U due to all the other electrons. And so this U and sigma S, this interaction with the surroundings, that's something that has to be calculated self-consistently. And often what happens is you can assume that these surroundings remain in equilibrium because they are in turn connected to other things all around it, which always maintain them in equilibrium. But then you can have quote-unquote hot contacts where these surroundings go out of equilibrium, in which case exactly what state they are in would have to be calculated self-consistently. And these are all, you know, areas of current research where people are looking at all kinds of interesting things, all kinds of interesting devices. And what I've tried to describe to you is a general framework, you know, with which you can think about all different kinds of things. Now, what I want to talk to you today more about is, one of the things I intend to do is, alert you to some of the limitations of this way of thinking, you know, things that are a kind of outside this way, although you may be able to extend it to handle some of those cases. And besides, I mean, my general purpose is also to kind of describe to you a different way of thinking of the environment or the surroundings. You know, one point I made very strongly, I mean, repeated a few times, is that just H is not enough when you are trying to describe a system, because just the Schrodinger equation might tell you that the rate at which you go one way is exactly equal to the rate at which you go the other way. And yet, because of the surroundings, that's not really true. And so you have to consider the interaction with the surroundings. But today, I'll be describing to you a different viewpoint, actually, which gives you another way of looking at the surroundings, another way of dealing with the surroundings. Not completely different, it's connected, but you'll see it's a very different viewpoint. And the two important concepts here are these correlations and entanglement. And what I'll try to get across to you in this lecture is, you know, these concepts in that order. We'll first take an example to see kind of what correlations really mean. And this word correlations in this context means something totally different from this correlation function that we talked about in the earlier lectures. You know, when discussing this thing, I said, instead of electron density, you have this correlation function Gn, which tells you the correlations of the one electron wave function. Now, that correlation is totally different from what we'll be talking about today. This is a whole different correlation. See? And so first, what I'll try to do is go through an example so you get an idea of what we are talking about when we say correlations. And entanglement is kind of related, but a little subtler. So we'll get there. Okay. So the problem that, again, you have this bottom-up point of view, which is you always start with the simplest device, you know, simplest thing you can think of, and see what happens. And the simplest device, which will illustrate this issue of correlations, is something like this. That a device which has two levels. Of course, levels usually come in pairs. So basically, it's like one level, but then an upspin and a downspin, for example, which have both had the same energy, epsilon. They're usually degenerate, the two spin levels, no magnetic fields. And you have got two contacts across it with two different chemical potentials, mu1 and mu2. The question is, what is the current versus voltage across this for this device? Now, one of the things I discussed the first day is the current versus voltage can depend strongly on the electrostatics of the problem and so on. Now, here, of course, I want to talk about something else. And so as far as the electrostatics, I'll assume this thing is very simple. That is, I'll just assume a simple model where these levels remain fixed with respect to that contact, and all I do is move this up and down. In real devices, as I mentioned, you have to worry about how these move. But that's a different thing which you understand, which you have talked about on Monday. So in this context, we'll keep that as simple as possible, so it doesn't complicate what we are talking about today. So here then the question is, if I measure the current versus voltage of this structure, what you'd expect is something like this. So we are putting a negative voltage on this contact, and what that does is it raises the chemical potential. Positive is on that side, and that's kind of what we are taking as our reference. And we are raising this up and down. And we know what would happen is, when you cross that level, at some point, current will start flowing. And one of the things we discussed before is that if we call this coupling gamma 1, this one gamma 2, then the current you'll get will be this Q over H bar times gamma 1, gamma 2 over gamma 1 plus gamma 2. This we have discussed on the first day. It's almost like two conductances in series, G1, G2 over G1 plus G2. Okay? And if those are equal, that amounts to half of gamma 1 that you have discussed. Okay. And if you look at the occupation of this level, you can also write that down. It's like a weighted average of gamma, you know, gamma 1 F1 and gamma 2 F2, etc. Now, this is what you'd actually expect for one level. If you had two levels, in the simplest theory, you'd have just put a 2 there, the two spins, the two levels, basically. That's it. Okay. Now, another interesting thing that one could look at, you know, this is a non-equilibrium property. You could look at an equilibrium property, which would be something like this. You could say, supposing instead of creating a potential difference between the two contacts, I kind of have the same potential across both, but I just move these levels up and down. That would be like not really applying a drain voltage, but applying a gate voltage. So with a gate, you can move these up and down. So their location with respect to the chemical potential changes. So I would kind of mark this axis with a mu. Now it's the, you know, mu1 equal to mu2. It's the same mu. And you could ask, how many electrons do I have inside the channel? How does the number of electrons inside the channel change with mu? Of course, experimentally, usually what you're doing is putting a gate voltage. But the effect of the gate voltage is to move these levels with respect to the chemical potential. And so I'm labeling this axis with the chemical potential and asking what that looks like. And what you might expect is that when I raise this up, at some point, two electrons will get in because there'll be two levels like so. And you'll see, you know, at some point you'd cross this and you'd get two. Okay, so that's the simplest theory, where you have completely ignored all interaction between electrons. Now, of course, we all know that we have to include this interaction between electrons. And on the first day, I explained how in the self-consistent model, you usually put that in through the U. So the point to remember then is that here, when you try to fill up those levels, as you fill them up, they will kind of float up on you because you got electrons in there, you see. So if you did this self-consistently, what you'd find is, using the model that we have discussed, you'd actually end up with a curve that would look, say, more like this. In other words, instead of just stepping up, it would take you some amount of potential before you can actually fill them both up, because they're kind of floating up on you as you go along. Okay. And same with this current. If you did this using a self-consistent field model or this mean field theory that we have discussed, eventually you'd get to the same value, but then it would be dragged out like so. Okay. Now, the actual result, which is what I want to describe to you, how you get that and how you understand it, looks something like this. The correct result that has been experimentally observed with all kinds of structures, seems quite clear what it should be, is the following. Instead of going up like so, it actually would step up to 1 and then at a later point go up to 2. So in other words, it wouldn't just go continuously like that, but rather it would go up to 1 and then what's this difference, that's what you call the single electron charging energy, U0. And after some point, it will step up. And the point is to understand this, how that happened. And the second thing I'll try to explain is, when you look at the current versus voltage, there also you'll see a step, you see? See an interesting step like this. And what makes the step even more interesting is, see, this is 0, let's call this 2, I mean 2 in the sense of in those units. And for this discussion, I'm assuming gamma 1 is equal to gamma 2, because exactly what the height of this plateau is will depend on the relative values of gamma 1 and gamma 2. But let's assume those are equal for this discussion. Then what will happen is, if this is 0, in fact, let me call the maximum 1, so it's kind of normalized in your thinking, then this plateau is actually 2/3, which is a little surprising. You see, here, you know, it's 0, 1, 2. So you can kind of say, well, you know, electrons come in whole numbers, and so it's 0, 1, 2. That looks fine. But with current, with that viewpoint, you'd have said, well, if this is 1, then the plateau should have been half, not 2. Where did this number 2/3 come from? You see, that's a little harder to understand. So what I'll be describing to you then is a different viewpoint where you'll see naturally why it's 2/3. And once you have it, you can rationalize it and get a little more insight as to why it's 2/3. But the reason I go through this example is, in a way, I think it's the simplest example that really illustrates what correlations mean. In this context, you see? Remember, we're talking about correlations and entanglement, and this illustrates correlations very well. This is a little too simple for entanglement. And so, after this, I'll go to something a little more complicated, one with not 2 levels, but 4 levels. And that you need to understand to illustrate entanglement. You see? That's the one. Okay. Now, this different viewpoint that I want to talk about, it works something like this. You see, these are what are called 1-electron levels. In the sense, the way you think is, I've got a level, I can put in an electron, and I can take it out. Put in an electron, take it out, that's how you think. Now, a totally different viewpoint is to say that I'll take this device, and the levels I'll write down will be the states of that system. So, in other words, I've got a system here, which has 2 states, 2 levels available, but it has kind of 4 states. 4 states in the sense that I may have no electrons in there, which means none of these levels contain anything. Or I could have 1 electron in this one. Or I could have 1 electron in that one. Or I could have both filled. That would be like 2 electrons. So overall, there's like 4 states. And it's almost like a binary number with 2 bits. You know, you could represent 4 things. 0, 0, 011011. So you'd write the states of that system then, in this viewpoint, you'd write it like this. Now, I mean, you could kind of pictorially draw it this way. So you'd have a 00 state, and then a 10 state, which means one of them is occupied. This might be like your upspin is occupied, no downspins. The downspin is occupied, no upspins. And you could call this 11. So in general, I guess if I call these levels, the levels I had here, if I call them just for my, like an A and an A bar, in the sense that A was one of those states and A bar is like the opposite spin. So upspin and downspin. Then I could have labeled this as, you know, this is like no electrons any place. This is like an electron in the A state. This is like an electron in the A bar state. And this one is kind of different. In a sense, you've got two electrons in there. It's the A bar state. So that would be another way of labeling things. But the point is your system now has four states. And the difference between this viewpoint and this viewpoint, you know, it's actually takes a while to get used to that one. This is actually a more powerful, a more general one, but takes a little more getting used to. Here, the way you think is every level has a maximum occupation of 1. So the occupation of these levels is somewhere between 0 and 1, the way you usually think. That's an average number. Of course, actually, you either have an electron or you don't. But this is an average number. You could view it as a time average of over long times. Now, here, though, it's like the system has to be in one of these states. So not having an electron means it's in this state. So the probability of that this state is occupied is 1, if there are no electrons any place. If there's 2 electrons in there, the probability is 1 for this state. And in between, you'll have all kinds of situations where there'll be various probabilities for these 4 states. But overall, of course, all 4 probabilities must add up to 1, because the system must be someplace. There is, of course, no such requirement here. Nothing needs to add up to 1 as such. It's the occupation of this somewhere between 0 and 1, occupation of that somewhere between 0 and 1. Here, I can write down probabilities of these 4 things, but then it will be some value for each one of them, and they add up to 1. Now, the question is, how do I describe current flow and calculate things of interest, curves like this, from this picture? Now, I'll do that in a minute. It's a little easier, I mean, just to get used to it, to do an even simpler problem quickly before doing this one. In the sense that here I took 2 levels, and the reason I took 2 levels is that's like the simplest problem I need to illustrate what I mean by correlations. But if I took an even simpler problem where I just have 1 level, that would be a little too simple to illustrate correlations, but it's simple enough to kind of see how the new viewpoint works. You see, that way it's really simple. So if you had a problem with just 1 level, and a gamma 1, gamma 2, then we know the current through this, the maximum current that goes through this would be this Q over H bar, gamma 1, gamma 2. Over gamma 1 plus gamma 2. That's the maximum that goes through it. Under specific bias conditions, as we have discussed, the current is actually F1 minus F2. And maximum is when, you know, this is like 1, this is like 0. That's when you got maximum things. And, I mean, corresponding to that level. So you got electrons coming in from here. The Fermi function for this contact is 1. Fermi function for that contact is 0. And that's when you get the maximum. Now, question is, how would I do this in this new viewpoint, the system kind of viewpoint? Well, how many states would there be? Well, since it's only 1 level here, it can be either full or empty. And so I have 2 states, basically, 0 and 1. And what the system does is, every time an electron comes in, say from the left contact, the system goes from 0 to 1. So what the contact does is it induces a transition of the system from 0 to 1. It was empty, it became full. So what is the rate at which that happens? Well, you could write gamma 1 F1. You know, that's the rate at which electrons would want to come in from the left. Or you might have electrons coming in from the right if F2 happened to be not 0 but something. So to be general, you could write, okay, gamma 1 F1 plus gamma 2 F2, for example. Now, every time an electron leaves the system, that's when, of course, you go back from 1 to 0. So you could write this way. And now the rate at which that happens, of course, depends on 1 minus F1. You see, just as these transitions are made possible if an electron happens to be there with that energy. Here, it's like you need an empty spot there. So you'd have something like that. So this is the rate at which it goes up from 0 to 1. That's the rate at which it comes down from 1 to 0. Okay. Now, one little thing to remember is that, you know, these Fs are, of course, Fermi functions. So these are functions of energy. So when I write a number like this, of course, what I'm really looking at is the value of the Fermi function at this energy. So when I say F1, you know, F1 is a function of energy. It's different at different points. You know, it's close to 1, below mu 1, it's 0 above it. But what I'm really talking about here is, what is the value of F1 right at that energy? So it's a number. That's what I'm writing there. So here, what is the value of F2 right at that energy, of course. Okay. So now the next step is to find out what is the probability the system will be in state 0 and what is the probability the system will be in state 1. And what you say then is that, well, P0 times this rate must be equal to P1 times that rate. Why? Because P1 times this tells you the rate at which you're coming down. P0 times this one is the rate at which you're going up. And if you're talking steady state, then whatever's going up must be balanced by whatever's coming down. That's the steady state distribution of things. And so you could say that P1 divided by P0 would be equal to gamma 1 F1 plus gamma 2 F2 divided by gamma 1 times 1 minus F1 plus gamma 2 times 1 minus F2. So the way this works is, if I take a, you know, if I multiply this way and multiply that way, you see, product of P0 times that tells me the rate at which I'm going up. Product of P1 times that, you know, tells me the rate at which I'm coming down. And steady state, those two things are balanced. And hence, P1 over P0 is the ratio of those rates. That's how I'm writing it. Okay. Now, what I want, of course, is P1 and P0 individually. I mean, I got the ratio, but I want them individually. And this is where I make use of that other property, which is the sum must be 1. Because you see, the system has to be someplace. So the sum of those probabilities must be 1. So I want to make sure, make use of the fact that P1 plus P0 is 1. And that's where you can use this little algebraic trick. That if I have P1 over P0, and I want to write P1 over P1 plus P0, what I should do is, on this side also, take the numerator and just add it to the denominator. You know, I had P1 over P1 over P0, and I want to make it this, then I should just take this down and write it. And the algebra is very simple because, you see, you have a F1 here and you have a 1 minus F1. So when you add the two, it just becomes 1. You see? And so, what happens is, instead of this, you then end up with gamma 1 plus gamma 2 in the denominator. Okay? So, bottom line is, let me just take this out. So, you see it. That's the bottom line. And then, of course, I can say that P1 plus P0 must be 1, so I can just drop that. So basically, what I found is P1. And if I wanted, I could find P2 also. P0 also. I just have to subtract this from 1. But you see, I've got back a result that I usually, that like in my first lecture, I'd kind of deduced from this picture. You see, from this picture, we had said, what is the occupation of that level? Well, it's, you know, gamma 1 F1 plus gamma 2 F2 divided by gamma 1 plus gamma 2. And I said, you know, that makes good sense because one contact wants to impose F1, the other one wants to impose F2. And so the average number is this. Now here, of course, P1 means the probability I have one electron inside my device, which is basically the occupation factor for that one level. So you see, in this picture now, I have basically got that same answer. And if I wanted to calculate current, then what you'd say is that, look, you know, I've got these two rates here, but, you know, one of them corresponds to electrons coming in from contact one, while the other one corresponds to electrons coming in from contact two. Here also it's the same thing. So this is for electrons going out into contact one. Now, when I take P0 and multiply by the sum, I get the total rate of things. But supposing I look at just the part that came from contact one, then you see this would kind of tell me the rate at which electrons are coming in from contact one. And this would tell me the rate at which it is going back out into contact one. And so if I want the current at contact one, it's kind of the difference between those rates. Overall, of course, this is balanced by this. But the thing is, what I now look at is not the full thing, but just the part that came from contact one. And then if I looked at just the part that came from contact two, it would be just, it would be the opposite of that. And you'd get I2. So that's how you'd get currents. So this I'm using as a sort of the simplest problem, because that's a good way to get used to a new viewpoint. You know, take something as simple as possible. But as I mentioned earlier, this one is a little too simple to illustrate correlations. So what we need to do is do a slightly more complicated one. And in this case, what I'll do though is, instead of carrying around these F1s and F2s and trying to be general, to keep the algebra in a more clear, and I'll kind of think about situations where the relevant F1 and F2 are either ones and zeros. You know, so let's say when you have applied a bias that is big enough that this F1 is 1 and this F2 is 0, then you can see this would have been just gamma 1 divided by gamma 1 plus gamma 2. So that way, you know, algebra looks a little simpler. So that's kind of the thing I'll be doing here. So you won't see any F1s and F2s, but that's because we are talking about a bias condition where they have certain specific values that I'll try to explain. Okay, so that's as much for this one level thing. Now let's do the real problem we want to do. So this problem, as I mentioned, you have these, the zero level, no electrons any place, one electron in there, in which case there are two possibilities. You could have one upspin electron or one downspin electron, and then you could have two electrons in there. Now, what's the energies of these levels? Well, this one has an energy of just zero. Just no electrons in there. Now, if you have one electron in there, in that one electron level called epsilon, then, see, the energy of that would be epsilon. Whether it's this one or that one, same energy, upspin and downspin, exactly the same. Now, the trickier one is to write the energy of that one. I got two electrons in there. So the energy of that two electron system would be like 2 epsilon. Except that it's a little more complicated because they have the interaction between them. As long as it was one electron, I didn't have to worry about interactions. Now it's 2 epsilon. So it's 2 epsilon plus their interaction energy, U. So I add U to it. 2 epsilon plus U. Now again, the question is, when I put this in connection with a contact, electrons can come in and out. And so what is the rate at which you have transitions between these levels? So if an electron happens to be available at a with this energy, then you might say it will come in and it will take you from 0, 0 to 1, 0. So you could call that, say, gamma 1, F1. Or if you had two of them, you know, gamma 2, F2, you could add that. Actually, for the moment, let me just write 1, and then we'll talk about how to add the second, you know, talk about adding the second one. I mean, we understand when I write gamma F, what I really mean is gamma 1, F1 plus gamma 2, F2. I just don't want to clutter up the picture, lots of things. But basically, gamma F that goes up, and then you could say, well, what comes down would be gamma times 1 minus F. Again, implied, that really means gamma 1 times 1 minus F1 plus gamma 2 times 1 minus F2. Something from contact 1, something from contact 2. Same story here. Now, the point I want to make, that this is of course an important part of understanding this one, is that when I want to write transitions from 1, 0 to 1, 1, or 0, 1 to 1, 1, it's slightly different. And it's like this. You know, I said that F is a function. So what number do I put in here? This F is really the Fermi function corresponding to an energy of epsilon. Because you need an electron with energy epsilon in order to take the system from here to there. Because energy is conserved, it went from 0 to epsilon. Now, to take it from here to here, though, what you need is an electron with an energy of epsilon plus u. That's the point, not epsilon. So if I want to write down the rate at which it goes up here, I can't write gamma f. I mean, it's just that it's f at a different energy. So I should remember that it's really a different f that we are looking at, and I should put that in, you know, like gamma f prime. Just something as a reminder, it's a different energy. It's not the epsilon one, it's epsilon plus u. So in a picture like this, you know, I'm used to thinking, oh, do I have an electron at this energy? But for that second transition, I should really be thinking about an energy somewhere up here, you know, raised by another u. So if this is epsilon, it's almost as if there's a level up there at epsilon plus u. Because you need an electron to come in with that much energy in order to make the system make this transition. So physically you can say, oh yeah, that makes sense. You see, because one electron's already present, for the second one to come in, it needs a little more energy. It actually must have epsilon plus u to come in. Whereas if there was none in there, just epsilon would take you there. Here now you need epsilon plus u, because one's already there, it's the second one that you're trying to put in. But other than that, you see the picture's much the same. You know, gamma 1 minus F prime. And here, same story, going up, down. So, much the same, but the subtlety is, it's a different F here and a different F. I mean, same Fermi function, looking at different energies. Looking at the epsilon or the epsilon plus U. Okay. Now, this is where I said, after this, when we try to actually calculate currents and all that, instead of carrying all these Fs around, you know, F1s, F2, etc., we'll say, okay, let's look at a particular bias condition where these Fs are, say, both 0, or maybe 1 is 1, 1 is 0, etc. That's how you kind of go through it. Okay. So one possibility would be, you could start at, let's say we're trying to understand this curve, you know, with this two-thirds in there, why that's two-thirds. Now, let's first consider this situation when the bias is 0. For example, so bias is 0 means that I can redraw this picture here. So let us say we are in a situation where both these mu's are way below this level, somewhere here. So physically we know what to expect then. No current should be flowing really. No current should be flowing, no electrons can come in, etc. What I want to do is see it from here, from this picture, how that works. Now the thing is that because everything is down here, what it means is that my relevant Fs, whatever I'm looking at, you know, the F at this energy or the F at that energy, they're all 0, basically. All relevant Fs, either contact, it's all 0. Okay, so what that means is, that if I draw those arrows, basically I'll have a bunch of downward arrows. And the strength of those downward arrows would be like, you know, gamma 1 plus gamma 2. If I actually had to write the strength. Why gamma 1 plus gamma 2? Well, you remember when I wrote gamma times 1 minus f, it meant gamma 1 times 1 minus f1 plus gamma 2 times 1 minus f2. And we are thinking of a regime where those f's are all 0. So basically, it's just gamma 1 plus gamma 2. So if we write down these, but the important point is it's all downwards. No upward stuff. Okay. So question is, at steady state, what is the equilibrium, what is the, the probabilities of the system? You know, as I said, under steady state condition, you have a particular probability for this level, and this level, and it should all add up to 1. So my question is, if you had a situation like this, where would you expect the system to be? Well, it doesn't matter where you started it. The point is, all it can do is go downhill. So no matter, if you wait long enough, it will end up there. That's the thing. So you can do all the algebra, but at the end of the day, basically P00 will be 1. There's a probability of the system of being in a certain state will be 1. For this state, will be zeros elsewhere. System will be right here, which makes sense, of course. If all the mu's are somewhere down here, then you really don't expect any electrons to be inside your system. So the system ought to be in the zero electron state. No question. So that looks reasonable. And if you actually try to calculate current, of course, you'd get zero because it is sitting here and from here it goes nowhere. And here, of course, yeah, there is a rate for coming down, but then there's no probability of being here anyway. So whatever current you calculate, you get zero. That's no big deal. Okay. Now, the interesting one is this step. You know, and I said, what I was really heading for is, you know, why that's 2/3 and not half, you see? That's the thing. Now, that comes under the bias condition when it is something like this, you know, exactly what I've drawn here. You see, where one of these contacts is up here, so that the mu 1 is bigger than epsilon, so that if I look at f 1 corresponding to epsilon, I would actually get 1. You know, this is below mu, I'm assuming it's approximately 1. If I looked at f 2, it is 0. But then if I look at f1 prime or f2 prime, remember those are the ones that are responsible for this top part, for making the second transition. Those are still way above here, so it's really zero for both. So that's the situation we want to talk about. Under that bias condition, what I want to show you is you'll get 2/3. Now, of course, if you raise the bias even more, so the mu 1 has crossed up here and then you get 1 and then you put 1 there, that's when you get the second step. That will get you this level. And this one, as I said, no mysteries. In the sense, it is just our old answer times 2. So there's no mysteries. All the important stuff is in this region, you see, where the bias is such that one electron can come in, but if one electron's there, the second one can't. That's the one that we really want to do. So question is, how should we draw these rates? You know, that's the general picture. We now want to draw a kind of clean picture that's applicable to our specific biasing situation. So in our specific biasing situation then, as I said, the basic point is f1 is 1, f2 is 0, f1 prime is 0, and f2 prime is 0. That's the specific biasing condition we are talking about. Right? So, electron, you know, just like what I drew here, that's F1, that's F2, F1 prime, F2 prime. That's it. So, based on that, I want to draw the rates. So, this is gamma F. Remember, gamma F was my shorthand for gamma 1 F1 plus gamma 2 F2. And so, that would amount to gamma 1. Taking me up. Similarly, gamma 1 minus f was shorthand for gamma 1, 1 minus f1 plus gamma 2, 1 minus f2. So that comes to gamma 2. Same, works much the same way for the other spin level. Gamma 2 coming down, gamma 1 going up. Nothing more to write. Now, what about the upper part? Well, that's basically all downwards from now. In this bias condition. Why? Because, you know, F1 prime and F2 prime are both zeros. So what that means is there's no gamma F primes. You know, that's gamma 1 F1 prime plus gamma 2 F2 prime. But then both are zero, so that's out. So no upward rates, all downwards. And those downward rates are like gamma 1 plus gamma 2. But here you have kind of this zero mu situation that because you can only go downwards, what it means is that this state is essentially out of the story. Even if you originally forcibly put it there, if you wait long enough, it will be somewhere down here. So all the important stuff is, will be happening around here. Let me draw that you can kind of leave out of your thinking. So basically what we need to do is figure out that if you have a bunch of three states like this, with these rate equations taking you up and down, what is the probability that it will be in this state, that state, or that state, etc. That's it. Okay. Okay, so I guess I can, I think I can erase this. And now, in order to obtain the steady state occupation of these levels, then we say, well, again, if I draw a line here mentally, you can think of the rate at which stuff's going up and the rate at which stuff's coming down, and they should be equal. So the rate at which things are going up, you could write as P00 times gamma 1 up, gamma 1 up again. So it'll be like 2 gamma 1. Should be equal to the rate at which stuff's coming down, which is probability it's in A times gamma 2, probability it's in A bar times gamma 2. So it'll be so steady state condition, that's the rate at which kind of electrons are coming in. Whenever there's zero electrons, one comes in. And whenever there's one electron in there, it goes out, and those are equal. So then my usual thing, you could write the ratio. Now, after this, of course, if you remember, the next step is to make use of that little property that the sum of all the probabilities must be 1. And the thing to note is that what must be 1 is PA plus PA bar divided by P00, not without this 2 in there, of course, because basically it's in three possible states. The fourth one is out of the picture anyway. So the probabilities of being in one of these three, that all has to add up to 1. So what I can do is take the 2 out of here and put it there. And now I want to make use again of that rule that I want to put in a PA and a PA bar. I want to take this numerator and add it to the denominator so that what's here then becomes 1 and I have solved my problem. And you know, the rule is, if you add it down here, you do the same thing here and it will work, right? So you do the same thing here. That's it. Let me back up for a minute. So we had this, right? 2 gamma 2 over gamma 1. Oh, did I write it opposite? Yes, yes, thank you, thank you. Very good. Thank you. Yeah. It should have been, as you pointed out, 2 gamma 1 over gamma 2. Because, you see, this is P00, this is 2 gamma 1. So that's what you should have up there. And that's the gamma 2. That's what should be down here. Thank you. And now I want to do what I had said, namely add the PA plus PA bar to this. And same thing you do here, 2 gamma 1 plus this. That's it. And This is 1. So I can drop that. So it now tells me what PA plus PA bar is. Now, if I want to know the current, well, basically I can look at, say, at what rate the electrons go out into contact 2. Because in my specific bias condition, the way we have done this, this is 1. No electrons go out this way. They just come in this way and go out that way. So nothing really goes out this way. So basically you can just look here and see what goes out, and that will tell you the current. So the current is like PA plus PA bar times gamma 2. This is it. Now, again, if I really want to write current, if you remember the way I defined things, the gamma had the dimensions of energy, and the rates are really gamma over h bar. So here I kind of took a little shortcut on the notations, in the sense I used gammas as the rates rather than gamma over h bar. If you had put all those in, you'd have got a h bar here. And then this, of course, tells you the rate at which electrons are flowing. If you really want the current, you should restore the Q. So overall, then, if you actually wrote down the current, that's what you'd get, finally. See? So now you can compare what we have. See? So I guess I can take this out. So that maximum current is 2 gamma 1 gamma 2 over gamma 1 plus gamma 2. That's this maximum value. And that is just twice what we had before. That we haven't gone through and obtained from this point of view at all. But I'm just saying, if you go through that, you'll actually get that same answer. But the point is, what we calculated is, of course, this plateau. The bias condition we assumed was relevant to that plateau. And the value we have got is 2 gamma 1 gamma 2 over 2 gamma 1 plus gamma 2. That's the value we got. You see, there's a little difference. It kind of looks similar, but there's a 2 there. It's a little difference there. That's the thing. Okay? And if you put gamma 1 equal to gamma 2, this one comes to, you'll notice, I think, if you put those two things equal, then it will become like 2 gamma 1 squared divided by 2 gamma 1. So it will be like gamma 1, I think, right? Yeah. Whereas if you put those two things equal, what you'll get is gamma 1, 2 gamma 1, if you put that gamma 2 equal to gamma 1. Okay, so, and that's the point I'd made before, that this plateau is like 2/3 of the full, if gamma 1 equal to gamma 2. Otherwise, the ratio is a little more complicated, depending on what those are. Okay. Now, what exactly happened? I guess I showed you the algebra. How do you understand this? Now, the best rationalization I've seen of this is something like this. That, you see, whenever you have, you know, we had discussed before that if you just had one level with a gamma 1 on this side and a gamma 2 on that side, then the current you get is, I think I could just look at this. For one level, you get this answer, gamma 1, gamma 2 over gamma 1 plus gamma 2. And the 2 there basically says you got 2 levels. Now, when you look at this one, you kind of have the feeling that, you see, it is as if when for coming in, the rate is 2 gamma 1, and for going out, the rate is gamma 2. If you think of it that way, then you say this looks reasonable. It is like 2 gamma 1 times gamma 2 divided by 2 gamma 1 plus gamma 2. You see? So one way to understand this is to say that somehow what has happened is that the rate at which you're coming in has become 2 gamma 1, which kind of looks reasonable. You know, you say, I got 2 levels, so it should be 2 gamma 1 in a way, you could say. It's acting as if you got 2 levels. But then when you're getting out, it's as if it's just 1. As if. So That, and again, I'm saying this is not a convincing argument. It's just a matter that knowing the answer, how you could try to understand it or rationalize it and see what happens. And basically, the way you justify this is by saying, you see, I got two levels. If it's empty, I have two ways of getting in. I could get in the upspin or the downspin. But once I'm in, till I get out, the next one can't come in. That's the difference. You see, that's the difference between having a situation like this and having a situation with two independent levels. Two independent levels means you just go through one, go through the other, no problem getting in, getting out, no blockade, etc. But these are interacting things. Once one is there, the second one can't come in. And so, in this picture also, you kind of see that. It's like, if there's no electrons, when you're coming in, it's like you've got two ways getting out. But wherever you are, there's just one thing then coming back. And you cannot quite, do not have all these other paths available to you. So this is the way one would think about this. And just to finish up the morning's lecture then, I'd like to, you know, I said that the reason I went through this example or brought up this example was to illustrate the meaning of correlations. See? And the way this is relevant is the following, that if you look at the states, the occupation of these states, what you'll notice is that if you actually calculated P00, PA, and PA bar, what you'd find with gamma 1 equal to gamma 2 is that those are actually just 1/3 each. I think I just erased it, but if you remember, the expression I had was PA plus PA bar divided by P00 is equal to, I believe, 2 gamma 1 over gamma 2. I think that's what I had. And if gamma 1 is equal to gamma 2, it tells you that that ratio is 2. So you can see, and again, because of the symmetry of everything, you expect those two things to be equal. So basically, all three things are kind of equal. So it's really just 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, if you calculated it. So what we are saying is that that system has 1/3 probability of having no electrons there, 1/3 of having an upspin, 1/3 having a downspin, and 0 probability of having 2 electrons in there. That's the situation, really. Okay. On the other hand, if you do a 1 electron type picture, you know, the kind of picture we have here, where, okay, you have managed to calculate a certain F for this level and a certain F for that level. So let us say you have got some FA and FA bar. You know, this tells me the occupation of level A. This tells me the occupation of level A bar. So you might say, well, if I know those things, I could calculate these probabilities. So you could say, okay, what P00 should be is, that's the probability both are empty. So that should be like 1 minus FA times 1 minus FA bar. You know, because 1 minus F tells me that probability A is empty. 1 minus F bar tells me probability A is, A bar is empty. Okay. So when I write PA, what I'll do is I'd write FA times 1 minus FA bar. Because this is the probability that you have an electron in state A, but none in state A bar. Because if you had something in state A bar, that would be a fourth quantity, which is 0. And the whole thing, of course, adds up to 1. So that's 0. But from a one particle viewpoint, you know, we have a level which is either occupied or unoccupied. You know, that's the way you're normally thinking. Then you'd say, okay, this ought to be equal to that, this ought to be equal to that, this ought to be equal to just the reverse. And this ought to be equal to so you might say that, well, if I can find two numbers such that these four equations are satisfied, then I could work with a one particle viewpoint. I could say, well, you know, I got two levels, they're occupied according to this, and then I'll be done. And the thing is, you can't really find two numbers which will do this. Why? Because just look at this one, you know, because Oh, I'm sorry. I wrote this last one wrong because this is PAA bar, which means both are occupied. So what I should have written is FA times FA bar. I wrote that last one wrong. Yeah. And you see the problem right away. You see, if this is 0, either this is 0 or that's 0. So you take your pick. Let's say we put that equal to 0. Good. Then there's no way you can get that because you have already put that equal to 0. How do you get a 1/3 out of that? So there's no simple one particle picture that you could use, you know, that would really describe what's really going on there. And why? Well, it's because the two levels are occupied in a correlated way. You see, there's a correlation here. It's this whole thing about, you know, that in if you take a course in statistics, you talk about this correlation that you're tossing two coins and you can find out what's the probability of getting a head or a tail, and you get a probability of head or tail. And as long as the two coins are independent, uncorrelated, you can write down various probabilities this way, multiplying it out. Okay, what's the probability of getting a head here and a head here? Okay, we multiply probability of head on this, multiply by the probability of head on that. But if the coins are correlated in some way, you know, so that there's a very big chance that when you get heads on one, you'll get a head on the other two, let's say, then you know that doesn't work. You can't think in terms of separate things. And that really is the essence of like the distribution we have here. It's like whether A is occupied is not an independent variable from whether A bar is occupied, in the sense that both would never be occupied. See? So this is what you then refer to as this strongly correlated regime. So when you look at this picture, this I versus V, out here there's no problem. Out here again, there's not much problem. If you actually calculated the occupation of levels, you'd find that whatever you get here, I didn't go through that exercise, but if you actually go through it, you'll find that whatever you get here, you could understand this way. It would all fit. Whatever you get here, you can understand that way, which is why the currents are also whatever you'd have got from common sense anyway. I mean, from the old viewpoint, from the simple viewpoint. The problem is, of course, this part. That bias region where when you have two levels, one electron can come in, but the second one can't. And that leads to this strongly correlated regime. Now, the other thing that I didn't talk much about is how to understand this easier thing, the equilibrium calculation. You know, the one where I said, you just move mu and see how the number of electrons changes. And if you went through that, what you'd find is, again, this viewpoint would tell you that the number of electrons steps up from 0, goes to 1, and then goes on to 2, instead of gradually going from 0 to 2. So what happens is, when you go through that analysis, it's sort of like this system starts out here, and then when you raise mu, you get to a point where the system goes to this, you know, this one or that one. And then eventually the system goes there. So that's how kind of that works. But I didn't really go through that. But the point I wanted to make here is that this is a picture you can actually understand also from a one particle diagram relatively easily. This one. Because what you could argue is the following. You could say that, you know, here I'm just putting the same mu on both. So this is kind of an equilibrium problem. It's an equilibrium problem, and you've got two levels, and you're saying that as I raise mu, how many electrons will I have inside my device? And as I said, the experimental fact is that it goes from 0 to 1 to 2. And the question is, how do you understand it from this picture? You know, after all, you'd say, well, when I raise mu, once I cross those levels, I should have two in there. What? And if I can't cross it, you know, they'll be floating up on me, so I should get something gradual like this. Why this 0, 1, 2? And this you could rationalize using this self-interaction correction idea. That is, you could say that no electron feels anything due to the other, due to itself. So you'd argue that when an electron comes in and occupies this level, what happens is the other one floats up. By you. Why? Because you say, I have an electron in there. Because an electron is in there, the other one feels that potential and has floated up. Now, why didn't this one float up? Well, because nothing feels, the level doesn't feel anything due to itself. Of course, it feels something due to electrons in that level, but then that one being up there is empty anyway. So there's nothing to feel, you see? So this is a self-consistent situation. You know, this is down here because there's nothing to feel from here, and this is up here because there is something to feel from there. And because it's up here, it doesn't get filled. Because it's down here, it gets filled. So it's all kind of nice and self-consistent. And so if you actually put in this self-interaction correction, that is when you are using a mean field theory, if you say that this mean field U that the electron feels due to other electrons has a self-interaction correction so that it feels something only due to others and not due to itself, you could get this curve. You see, if you adjusted your parameters, right, got it. Although, again, for a two-level system, it's easy to see. With lots of levels, there's enough subtleties involved that, you know, there's lots of papers. As I said, if you did a Google search, you'd see lots of papers on self-interaction correction, you know, how to implement it. But in principle, you could do it. But the point I want to make is, although you can do it for equilibrium problems, it's really not so easy for non-equilibrium problems. You see, because if you take this viewpoint, then what would happen is this plateau would not be at two-thirds, but would rather be at a half. Because basically what you have is, in this situation, one level has floated out of your window. You just have one level to go through. Well, so you should get half the current you get when you have two levels. But the thing is, this non-equilibrium problem, there is this subtlety where it's really neither one level nor two level, but something in between, you know, 30% more than one level somehow. And so it's a little bit different. And so the point I want to make is, again, a lot of the work, you know, in studying, especially in molecular electronics, people have spent, you know, a lot of effort in trying to understand what kind of a U one should use in that context. And, you know, in quantum chemistry, there has been an enormous amount of work on this subject. And usually, though, it is largely motivated by equilibrium problems. And DFT, density functional theory, is one of those methods that has been very successful in the sense it is really a way of choosing this mean field, you know, something beyond Poisson equation. You know, what corrections do you need to the Hartree approximation? That's the issue. And DFT gives you a very good way of doing it, which actually describes a very wide variety of equilibrium problems extremely well. See, and it's been remarkably successful. But the point I try to make is, just because it has worked for equilibrium problems, is actually no guarantee it will be adequate for non-equilibrium problems. See, because just because you can fit that one, doesn't mean you can fit this one, because non-equilibrium comes with its own subtleties, you know, which are essentially, you know, non-equilibrium issues, really, which are hard to do justice to. So maybe one can find appropriate mean fields that will do this, but that really needs to be looked at much more carefully. The one last note I want to just end on and that point out is, this viewpoint, you know, what I've introduced to you this morning is kind of a whole different viewpoint, that usually we work in terms of a one electron picture like this. And what I introduced you to is what's called a multi-electron system, or sometimes called the Fock space. That is the one where, instead of a one-electron Hilbert space, you're using, I guess in this case, a two-electron Hilbert space, two-electron space of things. And this kind of gives you a better understanding of actually what those one-electron levels mean. You see, like on the first lecture, I said, you know, for any material, you have a set of filled levels and a set of empty levels. But if you really think about it, that's not that obvious. I mean, what do you mean you have a solid with, you know, teeming, this millions of electrons in there all interacting? What exactly does drawing a level out there mean? See? And the thing is, of course, the best way to think about what it means is ask, how is it measured? How do you know the valence band levels? And that's why I think on the first day itself I said, the way you really know where those levels are is by photo emission experiments. What someone did was that shone light on it, saw what energy it took to knock an electron out of that system. You see? And that is then what we call the valence band level. The conduction band levels are a little harder because those are empty, so nothing to knock out. So you actually kind of have to put something in there. But the point is, that's how you do experiments. What you measure is what energy it takes to knock an electron out or to put one in. And you can see that some kind of here. And you see, if the system is somewhere here, then you could ask, what energy does it take to knock an electron out of that? Well, that means what energy does it take to go from here to there? And that's epsilon. On the other hand, if you are here, you could ask, what energy does it take to knock an electron out of the system? That means, what energy does it take to get from here to there? You know, that's epsilon plus u. You see? So, in a way, so when we draw these one electron pictures like this, those one electron levels, what they really mean is differences between multi-electron levels. So when I draw a filled state there, that corresponds to ionizing something, that is taking out an electron. And when I draw an empty level there, that's like adding what's called affinity levels, what it takes to add an electron. So those one electron levels are really like energy differences in this picture. You know, this is epsilon plus u, this is epsilon. Those are really what are showing up there. That's what you should interpret, kind of have in mind, because otherwise, you know, it's hard to understand what it means by having a one electron level. I mean, hydrogen atom is simple enough. There's one electron. But as soon as you go to two electrons, you see the meaning of these energy levels is not so clear anymore. And as soon as you go to helium, what does it mean when you draw levels like that? Well, again, when you draw the levels of a helium atom, what it really means is, what energy does it take to knock one electron out of the helium, from helium to helium plus. Okay? And so, in that sense, this picture is kind of needs to be at the back of your mind when you are thinking of this picture in a way, because this is a convenient representation of that one. That's really in a way a more fundamental picture in mind. You see, and when you calculate, say, the energy levels of helium, ideally, what you should be doing is finding the energy of helium. What you should be doing is finding the energy of helium with two electrons in it, and then finding the energy of helium with one electron in it, and then looking at the difference. That would be the right way to do it. Helium with one electron in it, that would be like your usual Schrodinger equation. This would be a much more difficult Schrodinger equation, because it will be not just, you won't have just a wave function psi of r, you'd have a wave function psi of r1, r2, because there's two electrons in there. So ideally, you should be solving that, and then looking at energy differences, etc. On the other hand, that's not what people do ordinarily. They've developed self-consistent field methods so that you can just solve the usual Schrodinger equation and put in some self-consistently determined potential, you know, like equivalent of kind of doing things self-consistently with Poisson for the other electron. That's what's always done, because with helium, maybe you could pull this off, but you can easily see with 14 electrons in there like silicon, that's just not doable, even with today's computers, you see, goes beyond. So, yeah, with that note then, you can stop for the morning. In the afternoon, I'll try to get on to a slightly more complicated example, which illustrates what entanglement means. Okay? Thank you.